With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. This episode could have been a wrap-up of the year 2011 in science news, but since 2011 isn't over yet, officially, I have to do that next week. Instead, something that's very apt and is long overdue is a presentation on Christopher Hitchens, and of course nobody can do that better than him himself. He was nicknamed Hitch, and if you're not familiar with him, he did pass away from esophageal cancer December 15, 2011. That was a couple weeks ago. He was a British-American author and journalist. His books, essays, and journalistic career span more than four decades. He was a columnist and a literary critic for The Atlantic, Free Inquiry, The Nation, Salon, Slate, Vanity Fair, World Affairs, and became a media fellow at the Hoover Institution in September 2008. He was a consistent guest on talk shows. He did so many lectures, it's really hard to choose, which this one actually is one of my favorites, so it wasn't so hard to choose this one. And in 2005, he was voted the world's fifth top public intellectual in a Prospect foreign policy poll. Of course, he was known for his admiration of George Orwell, Thomas Paine, and Thomas Jefferson, and he took a whack at many world leaders and figures, concentrating mostly, of course, on politics and how their influence showed itself in the world politics as well. This particular talk, he is discussing his recent tour, and he took questions at the Atheist Alliance 2007 conference in Washington, D.C., and he does propose the question between science and religion, and he also discusses secularism and theocratic governments and the role religion plays on how governments perform with their people and other world leaders and what could and should be done about it as far as he's concerned. So without much further ado, Christopher Hitchens.
Hey, thank you for coming, ladies and gentlemen. I woke this morning with an awful sense of ennui. And I thought to myself, how can this conceivably be the case? It's an extraordinarily beautiful September day. I'm going to cross the Potomac, and I'm going to be in the company of my mentors and my seniors and my teachers, my professors, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Samuel Harris, and I'm also going to see again my new neighbor and my new best friend, and I say it with platonic platitude, my love, the three most beautiful words in the new secular dictionary, Ayan Hirsi Ali. While I'm saying that, I should add that that it is considered by me, and I hope by all of you, a national disgrace that in the capital city of a secular democracy and republic, that our guest from Holland, the first, I think, political refugee from Western Europe since 1945, should have to go under armed guard about her business rather than be our most honored guest. And though it's not usual for me to be able to speak for the majority, I think I can say that, Ayaan, there isn't anyone in this room who wouldn't very proudly stand between you and anyone who wished you harm. And then I suppose I might add that those feelings of human solidarity and empathy and decency do not require divine permission. Do not proceed from a divine spark. In fact, in bold contrast, those feelings of elementary human solidarity and dignity and decency, in fact, have to be asserted against the divine and those who believe that they monopolize it. So how's that for my intro? Okay. My plan, I have now used the word majority, which was the source I suddenly realized of my ennui. This is the first time this year I've been in a room full of people who agree with me. And a tremendous sense of boredom and futility overcame me at this idea. And I was actually thinking of holding it right there and saying, look, ladies and gentlemen, comrades, friends, brothers, sisters, my impression is, and I don't think I'm mistaken, that people like yourselves come to events like this not to listen, or not just to do so, but also to speak, to impart. And I can certainly say that in this room there are many people. I've mentioned them already. I should also add my friend Matthew Chapman. I think I've earned my keep, wouldn't you agree, by making sure that he came to this conference. I could see him bringing out the heterosexual in some of you as he spoke today. So that I had thought really of saying, look, I will not shirk my task. I will end up doing the bulk of the talking, but that we ought to turn it over, as it were, to yourselves. Then I thought that might be a slight cop-out. But I'm going to yield back the balance of my time very quickly, nonetheless, after I've made... I thought I'd give you two or three things I think I've learned from the last year on campaign in our common struggle. And I'll just mention them quickly. I even wrote some of them down. The first thing I want to say is that every time I've debated with anyone, from some moon-faced Baptist to some smug rabbi or smarmy Catholic, it's always come up, and it's often been asked also by people who don't belong to those categories, well, how would you know that there could be goodness or virtue or morality without a supernatural dictatorship to enforce it? It's odd how people, when they're trying to be polite, are so insulting. When I was asked, when you say religion poisons everything, do you mean everything? As in, say, chess. Yes, in a way, because it attacks us in our deepest integrity. It says that we would be nothing, that we would have no principles, no humor, no irony, no decency, if we were not the property, the born property of a supernatural dictatorship and yearned for its rewards or feared its punishment. It attacks us in our core. And it does so in a related way that I think is also quite close to the core, don't know about you, by deforming our sexuality in the same manner, by saying that all of this too is a source of guilt and shame and fear. So yes, of course, it is poisonous, and we shouldn't grant the idea that even if metaphysically untrue, which it most certainly is, that religion is nonetheless the teacher of morals. It is, to the contrary, the source of misery, guilt, shame, unhappiness, and immorality. So given that you're all going to be having this argument either singly or in collective terms from now on, here's a suggestion I've made, and I've made it on a number of websites now, including some religious ones. I've made it in public, I've made it in print. Your antagonist has to be able to do the following thing. He has, or she, has to name a moral action performed or a moral statement made by a believer that could not be made or performed by an unbeliever. I've been doing this for months now. It's been on the Christianity Today website. It's been on Sally Quinn's wonderful site that I hope you visit, On Faith, the Washington Post Newsweek pages, and many other places. And I've been doing it for months. I haven't yet had one reply. except the injunction to love your enemies, which I don't think is a moral one. Do I love the theocratic suicide murderers? No, I don't. I dislike them. I wish to encompass their defeat. They wish to be martyrs? Okay, I'm here to help. But it would be positively immoral to say that one loved them. It would be disgraceful, cowardly, and masochistic to say so. And there, in three words, you have the root of Christianity. And that's, I suppose, why no Christian leader took the occasion of the theocratic, barbaric assault on our civil society to say that now was the moment to declare our love for these fascistic goons. So, my challenge also has a corollary, and you can try this on an audience too. Please, can you think of an immoral statement made or an immoral, wicked action performed by someone that could only have been religious? It's very strange. No one has any difficulty coming up with an answer right away to that. They can't answer the first, and they can't avoid the second. I won't say it's a QED, but I think that's very suggestive. I pass it on for what it may be worth. Second, Professor Dawkins, I meant to ask you this earlier. How long would you say Homo sapiens had been on the planet? Our species. I've read discrepant. Yes, would you? I mean, I'd like your best idea of how many years our species has been on the crust.
Well, it would depend a little bit on how you defined it, but probably it would be measured in hundreds of thousands of years.
Yes, okay. I'm grateful because Carl Sagan once said he thought about 250,000, but he wasn't completely certain. I've read estimates that it's less, but let's say it's 100,000.
Well, it's 250,000.
Yeah, well, 250,000 is a lot. It's more than I need. That's the great thing about the professor. Great thing about Professor Dawkins, scrupulously objective, but very generous. Very well. Let's call it 100,000 years that Homo sapiens has been on the planet. I'm addressing the point about the non-overlapping magisteria. Is it really true that there's an incompatibility between science and religion, or can they rub along? Let's help with the assisted suicide of this fatuous proposition and show that there's a radical incompatibility. Let's assume that we've only been around for 100,000 years, in the course of which time people were born, most of them, a good number of them at any rate, a large, high proportion of them dying in the process of being born, or killing their mothers in that process, live for many, many, many thousands and thousands of years, probably not longer than 2.5 decades, eventually dying either of their dentition, which they didn't understand, or of microorganisms that they didn't know existed, meanwhile conducting vicious and venomous turf wars with each other, almost invariably carrying rival fetishes into the fray to demonstrate their moral superiority over others, and that this went on with all its attendant misery and gruesomeness, perhaps with a slow upward curve towards the magnificent mammals that we are today, superb primates that constitute this meeting. And that's how it looked, that's how it was. And heaven watched that with folded arms for 94,000 years. And then about 6,000 years ago, it's time to intervene. In or around Bronze Age Palestine, by means of various human sacrifices. Now, I couldn't without difficulty be brought to believe in a virgin birth. It would take a lot to make me believe in that. Apparently there is such a thing as parthenogenesis. I don't really believe in resurrection, though according to the Bible it was very commonplace at the time. No big trick to it. All the graves opened at the time of the crucifixion and the inhabitants got out and walked around Jerusalem according to St. Matthew. So what's so important about just one more? But I could be brought to believe in this. I can't be brought to believe in the hypothesis that I've just given you. That cannot be true. It cannot be true. It is flat out not true. And if it were true, it would mean, as all such religious hypotheses do, that we won that argument too, because that's either a very bad design, a very inept and stupid one, or it's a very wicked and evil one. So that, I think, is a QED. And I thought I might pass that on to you, or as they say in some of the religious communities where I go, share it with you. Finally, this is a very fair-minded and decent and polite and open-faced society, the United States, of which I'm so proud to have become a citizen, taking my oath at the Jefferson Memorial on his birthday, which happens also to be mine, otherwise I wouldn't have made such a presumptuous gesture, and swearing, not just under my breath, but in the ceremony afterwards, explicitly to the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, the basis of our magnificent First Amendment, and making a short speech about President Jefferson's letter to the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut, who were frightened of being massacred by the Congregationalists of Danbury, Connecticut, wished the security of the state against religious persecution, and assuring them that there would forever be a wall of separation between church and state in the United States, and thus coining my new slogan, in which I also invite you to join me, Mr. Jefferson, build up that wall. But exactly and precisely because of the open-mindedness and fair-mindedness and decency and friendliness and hospitality of the United States, I think one has to confront the argument, most recently adumbrated by the president and leader of the free world, George Walker Bush, who says, teach the argument. Let's hear both sides on evolution versus creationism. You'd be surprised by how tenacious that view is, how tenaciously, I mean to say, that view is held by some people. But I feel one might help to get us over some of that hurdle too. First, there isn't an argument. There's not. You don't hear people saying, well, children, chemistry class is over, and then we'll have a break, and then there'll be the alchemy period. After we've done our astronomy, darlings, it'll be the astrology class. You don't get that, and of course it would be ludicrous if and hateful if it were proposed, but under the cover of religion, there's no stupidity that can't be advocated. And, well, I learned about Darwinism originally from reading up the debate between Thomas Huxley, coiner of the term agnostic, and Bishop Wilberforce, known as Sophie Sam, at the Natural History Museum in Oxford University. And I learned a lot from studying it as a debate. I think that should be taught, all right. I think people should be made to read about the confrontation between William Jennings Bryan and his opponents. And they should be made particularly to read the recent book by H.L. Mencken of all his collected writings on the man, Bryan, who he called, I think too kindly, the idol of all morondom. and Clarence Darrow. I am for the dialectical method, in case you wonder. In fact, Matthew's socialist rant this morning made me feel quite young again. But if that's going to be the case, if we are going to teach the argument, then there's another corollary, which I call to your attention. Any church that gets a tax break, or any church that gets any subsidy from the faith-based initiative, has to teach Darwin in Sunday school. Is the president aware of this implication? I take leave to doubt it. Should he and his supporters and friends be made aware of it? Yes, I think so. Anywhere it happens in your community or near your community, any time that you have a Dover, Pennsylvania in your neighborhood, make sure that this point doesn't get lost. So these were the three things that I wanted to share that I felt I'd learned from the trail, and I hope they've been some help, and I really would now prefer to be your hostage, and it's been very nice of you to have been my prisoners. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. We have our first question here. Linda, please begin.
Hi, Christopher.
Hello.
I'm Canadian, so my perspective is
Canadian Eurocentric, not
one nation under Canada.
You gave an excellent presentation at the University of Toronto on free speech. It's on Richard Dalton's website if people haven't had an opportunity to watch it. And this is a question I wanted to ask Diane, and I didn't get a chance to. And it's concerning our lack of free speech when it comes to Islam in the Europe, Canada, America. We can criticize literally any religious philosophy, ideology, but when it comes to Islam, we are forbidden and we are stopped, essentially. And most newspapers are afraid of publicizing anything that criticizes Islam.
During the controversy over the Danish cartoons, which everyone here will remember, which I think was the most suggestive such episode, I went on CNN to debate with some ghoul from some Islamic clerical organization. And I said to the presenter, look, just before we start on this, you have just pretended to show the cartoons on the screen, but you've, what is the word they use for drizzling them out so you actually can't see them? Pixel them up. And you haven't done this, I think, out of respect for one monotheism. You've done it because you're afraid, haven't you? You and your bureaus are afraid. And she said, yeah, that's right. And I said, well, in that case, I want to say to the person I'm on to debate with that that's the relationship he has with the media, that he's on here with a gun in his hand, or at least on the table, that he can pick up if he chooses. I just want to get that out of the way right now and have it clearly understood. I've been working in this profession for a very long time. I know many of the editors who wouldn't run those cartoons. And including my editor at Slate, who said, we're not running them. You can link to them from your page, if you like. Which I did, but we're not. And it was, I think, a national disgrace. I don't make my living from the First Amendment, though I do. It's my life, the First Amendment. I hope I don't sound exaggerated to say, it's my life, the principles of that amendment. And I have no right to betray it. And it's not to be handed off to the first bunch of clerical bullies who come round to the office. And that's what happened without a struggle. That's what I didn't like about it. And then, when a magazine I also do write for, Free Inquiry in Amherst, which I'm sure, I hope you all get, did run the cartoons, Barnes & Noble said they wouldn't carry the magazine. In fact, they pulled it from the rack. I told my publishers I'm not doing a single event at Barnes & Noble ever again, and I never will. So that's the fear factor, the blackmail factor, the sheer intimidation factor. But I think there's a much worse and more insidious one. There are many people who say, well, it's not that we're afraid, though they are. It's that we mustn't be mean. We've got to respect. We must defer to religious sensibilities. This is far, far more dangerous. Because eventually it's going to mean, it already does mean, has meant recently at the Washington Post, to take another cartoon example, that boring cartoonist you probably don't bother with on the funny page is called Burke Breathed. He did some Ramadan cartoon or another. I don't know what it... I did look at it. It wasn't terrifically funny, nor was it really very offensive, but it was shown by the editors of the Washington Post to the Muslim staffers, say, if we ran this, would your feelings be hurt? I said, well, if you're going to ask them and give them the chance to have an emotional veto, who would miss such a chance if they belonged to some cult? They said, yes, it would offend us. Didn't run. Again, crying before they hurt. Let's look for ways to surrender. Let's find a way to run up the white flag. This has got to stop. It has to stop right now, before it becomes impossible to oppose, before it's established itself as a principle within our culture. And I'm not sure we have very much more time before that's where we'll be.
We did our part. If you saw the cartoon that was created that included all of our speakers, you'll notice on one part of the scale there is someone that looks like Osama bin Laden. No, that's really the prophet. We're not scared. Next question.
Hi, I'm currently a resident of East Harlem, and I every Sunday go out and I see the people in their dress. And I also saw recently your debate with the Reverend Al Sharpton about God. Yeah. And I notice, very anecdotally, in the community that I'm living in now, that there's a strong correlation between people of faith and people who are able to sort of rise above the fray in terms of the general prostitution, drug addiction that I see so frequently. I'm wondering if you think that the discourse, the public discourse, I mean, looking at the crowd, are obviously very solidly middle class, your readers are mostly middle class, I assume, if the discourse should be different, or if you could choose a different discourse to talking about people, even globally, who are typically very poor. I feel like our discourse is very middle class centric. Mm.
Look, I've had this before, and now I'm having it again, and so thank you for giving me the opportunity. When I first unmasked my batteries against the ghastly Mother Teresa, or what's motherly about her? Hideous virgin and fraud and fanatic and fundamentalist. Shriveled old bat. as far from the nurture of motherhood as a woman could decently get. Anyway, when I first said what I thought about her, people said, it would have been 20 years ago that Bishop Fulton Sheen or someone like that would have said, you have offended, you've blasphemed, you've profaned the sacraments of Holy Mother Church. Something like that would have used to be said. You don't get that anymore. You're told, no, you've upset the Catholic community. And bear in mind, many poor Guatemalan immigrants and others go to these churches, and you're upsetting them. And just depriving them of comfort, and that's what's supposed to be the moral blackmail involved. Very much the same as involved in the kowtowing to Islam, by the way, and the case you mentioned, which is why in my book I go so far out of my way to denounce the cult of Dr. Martin Luther King, who, though a very admirable person, only felt able to express a perfectly decent and rational demand for fair and equal treatment for Black Americans in Baptist terms. Very clever strategically, but because of the feeling that now is very wide, you say middle class, to me, and I had a feeling you weren't saying it in a flattering tone, but never mind, I have a thick skin, I have a broad back, the entire white middle class has the absolute condescending view of Black Americans that they like preachers. They like preacher men. It's almost like their sense of rhythm. They go for the pulpit, as a result of which frauds of Chaucerian proportions, like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, automatically get the media baptism. They must be the spokesman for Black America in some way. This is a qualitative degeneration of a terrific order. I've met Sharpton a lot. I've debated with him frequently. I mean, he's a religious businessman of the most obvious kind. He just proves what is proved often in this country, that you can get away with anything if you put Reverend in front of your name, or if you can get people to call you Reverend. So that's what has to be opposed. We have to have the fortitude to say no. To those who are afflicted, to those who really are poor, to those who really are suffering, we will say, honestly, that those who offer them false consolation are not their friends. Who doesn't know by now that the cure for poverty is not charity in Calcutta? Who doesn't know that? Why did we suddenly decide to forget what we learned over the generations, that charity is an insult to the poor and a way of prolonging poverty, that Mother Teresa was not a friend of the poor, she was a friend of poverty, that there is only one cure for poverty, and that is, by the way, the liberation of women. And which works every time, against which all religion has always set its face and against which Mother Teresa spent a lifetime campaigning, to ensure that misery and poverty and dirt and disease and ignorance would continue so that there would be ever more people to testify to the Catholic faith. That's the way to face it.
I want to address a couple of things that you said about human evolution, because I'd like to take issue with them. I think in general, what you've been saying is wonderful, but I would not like you to talk about this general malaise of the human species. And this is what I would like to direct my observations about. First of all, you talk about this 100,000, 200,000, 50,000 year evolutionary scheme of humans being horrible and out of control. But it seems to me, I'm an ethnologist.
Not really, no.
Well, but I've studied human evolution for a long time. And it seems to me that there are really serious questions to ask about how human evolution evolved. And that has to do with the way religious people see us as a creature with some sort of supernatural or spiritual quality that had to appear someplace along our evolutionary line. Chimpanzees don't have it, and we do. When did that appear, and in what context? In an evolutionary context, it could occur only a couple of ways. Number one, it could appear just like that, and you have it, and your folks don't. In which case, we're dealing with a very serious problem in how you deal with your folks who aren't human. On the other hand, it could appear gradually in a Darwinian gradualist way, in which case, you're only half human, and you have only partially spiritual qualities. Seems to me that when we talk about human evolution and we want to use the quality of our evolved selves in dealing with religious people, what we ought to be doing is dealing with the impossibility of seeing this spiritual development in our own line.
Well, I'm quite happy to take that as a comment. And I've been, it's been called to my attention that I committed an injustice a moment ago. I ought to have said it was Borders bookstore. So would you mind switching your boycott? Thank you. I can't tell them apart, to be absolutely honest with you, but I do remember saying, whichever one it was, I wasn't going there ever again.
Christopher, Eddie Tabasher. Though I'm a constitutional lawyer, I moonlight as an atheist philosopher, and I've engaged some of the world's foremost Christian philosophers on college campus debates on God's existence. And I noticed, particularly in Missoula, Montana, 4 years ago when I debated Richard Swinburne in a formal debate on God's existence, that there is a hunger among college students for the specific technical atheist arguments against the existence of God. And I'm more than willing to interlope in the world of philosophy and study that as much as possible to do these debates. But I'm wondering, in your campaign for your book to the general public, have you found a similar kind of interest where there is a general receptivity on the part of many people to actually hearing the technical reasons why God does not exist or why we don't believe God exists?
Well, I don't know about a hunger for it. I've found a lot of belief in belief, if I can put it like that. People say, well, you ought to believe in something. President Eisenhower used to say that, you remember. He used to say, well, it's very important that you have a real faith, and I don't really mind which one it is. Sort of Republican ecumenicism of a rather tepid sort, but that goes, unfortunately, rather too well with certain kinds of soft multiculturalism. In other words, you be a Jain, and I'll be a Muslim, and you be Orthodox, and so forth. It's kind of oppressive, I'm okay, you're okay, multicultural drizzle. I think that all the ontological arguments for the existence of God were overthrown a long time ago. In fact, were overthrown well before Darwin and Einstein. But that now, which is why I gave the example I did give, now that we do have a rough idea of the age and origin of our species and of our cosmos, that it simply isn't possible for religion to do the reverse engineering it once did. No one would believe in this stuff if they started off knowing where we came from and how. It's just, it has the advantage of being the first and the worst explanation because we are pattern-seeking primates, and that's a good thing, obviously. It gives us the itch of curiosity and innovation, but it also means that we will prefer very often a conspiracy theory or a junk theory to no theory at all. So that's the epistemological question that has to be resolved, and I believe that we've succeeded in doing that. No, I prefer to argue that it would be horrible if it were true. I mean, I'm not an atheist, in other words, I'm an anti-theist. I don't, in myself, have any desire to live under a permanent, unalterable dictatorship. I don't wish it was true that I could be convicted of thought crime for what I was thinking when I was asleep, let alone for what I was thinking when I was awake. And I don't wish for a dictatorship I know had no part in choosing, that would not cease to torment me after I had died. I mean, I've actually been to all three of the axis of evil countries, and some other countries too, where the citizen is the permanent property of the state. When I was in Christian prep school, I used to wonder what heaven would be like if it really did consist of everlasting praise. Sounded like hell to me. But I couldn't picture it. And nobody can, of course, but I've seen the nearest approximation to it, which is North Korea, where it is the only duty and job and right of a citizen to eternally praise the divine leader and his divine father. I'll expatiate it a little, if you like. North Korea is only one short of a trinity. Kim Jong-il is only the head of the party and the army. He's not the head of the state. The head of the state is his dead father, dead for 15 years. It's a necrocracy. Or I tried this, a thanatocracy, a morsellocracy. And it's a life of constant groveling misery and fear and praise and thanks for the tiny handouts that you get. It's impossible to describe the nothingness of the life of a North Korean. But at least you can fucking die and leave North Korea. And with religious totalitarianism, there is no escape. It is absolute, it's complete, it's utter, it's horrifying. Now, I say freely, non-Serbia. I don't want that, and I don't respect anyone who does. So if they could prove it was true, I'd say you have all your work still ahead of you. But what a good thing it is that there's no evidence at all for such an obscene proposition. There.
First, I'd like to say that I truly appreciate the sense of humor of the speakers and the audience here. I think that's one thing that goes sort of underestimated amongst atheists, is that they're a funny lot. My question is...
As opposed to the numerous comedians who run the monotheistic world.
They don't realize they're being funny. Obviously, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been very divisive and controversial, but there is definitely a school of thought that says that that this is an ideological war that the West had to fight or should fight against Islamic fundamentalism and religious extremism in general. And I know you've been outspoken on this, but I would like you to, if you don't mind, to just expound a bit on how you feel about the rectitude of this being an ideological war that needs to be fought.
Well, it's an ideological war in the sense that I was just hoping to indicate, that it's against a very vicious form of totalitarianism. Totalitarianism will tend not to be content just with dominating the country that it happens to own. It doesn't want its citizens to be able to compare notes with other countries. It doesn't want there to be other countries where that comparison can be made. It will always have an aggressive tendency. If this is theocratic, then it has an even more sinister and equally matching tendency, which is this. Try and run a society out of a holy book, and I'll tell you what will happen. It's been tried. All the children's teeth will fall out. Okay? The elevator won't go all the way to the top of the building. There won't be enough food. There will be terrible microorganisms dining long and well on everyone in the society. That just will happen if you do this. But when this failure, this terrible state failure comes, there is no means by which you can blame the failure on yourself. You cannot be self-critical about it. Why, therefore? Why is there hardly a blade of grass growing between Kandahar and Kabul? Why is there misery? Why are there fistulas and ulcers everywhere? Because of the Jewish Crusader conspiracy, obviously, which means we must export our violence and failure by force to other countries. Well, we have no chance of ducking this confrontation. Since I think I understand some of the backstory of your question, I shall say now that anyone who says that there's a possibility of withdrawal from any of these countries is fooling themselves and trying to fool others. If we didn't learn one thing from 9/11 that seemed to me self-evident and obvious, we should have done. There is no over there and over here. For one thing, it's over here, and censoring the Washington Post And for another, when it breeds state failure and rogue statism, that's an immediate, imminent, direct threat to us, which I do not think was ever exaggerated. To the contrary, I believe the president and the vice president hugely understated the threat that was caused by societies like Iran and Afghanistan. People who say they inflated it are fools. And I relish the confrontation. And I think the 82nd Airborne is guarding us while we sleep. And I think that they're creating the space for my Iraqi and Kurdish and Afghan secular friends in a context in which otherwise they'd all be dead and we would have done nothing to help them. So, more than I thought. A little better than I thought, but not good enough. You are involved in this fight. Don't try and pretend you're not. And it will be going on only for the rest of your life, so you'd better decide quite soon which side you're on and how much have you done lately to help the fighters against religious terrorism in Afghanistan and Iran. What have you done lately to do anything about that? Ask that. It's too easy to blame it all on Bush and Cheney. Very well. I'll take any more questions on that if I haven't been clear enough.
This is on something else. You have a couple of really brilliantly succinct ways of sort of exposing the arrogance of religious people in claiming moral high ground and in claiming the provenance of morality by religion. But sometimes I feel that the best authors among you, and the best speakers particularly, because you're limited in time when you speak, can sort of appear to have a facile treatment of how we, or maybe can fail to sort of stand up for the secular values in a positive way that we espouse. And my question, I suppose, would be made clearer by pointing out that there's a lot in our biology that we know we want to leave behind. There are a lot of biological antecedents to some of the things that women have to face in the world still today. Of course, they're made sacred by religion, but I'm wondering if you could brilliantly articulate in 2 minutes exactly what the principle is that you use to derive your morality.
Well, I can't do it aphoristically, I don't think, for you. Because I'm sorry to say your question wasn't epigrammatic enough. Didn't give me enough of an erection. But I can tell you this. There are things I know that we all know here that I was never taught. Okay. That I don't think I flatter myself by saying are innate in me, to do with fairness, the treatment of other people, with the care for others, that I expect and hope that they all manifest to me in return. My favorite example is taken from a very famous English book by Professor Richard Titmuss, who's a great old English socialist. It's called The Gift Relationship. And it's about why the British National Health Service has never had to pay anyone to give blood and has never run out of it. There's always enough blood. There are always enough donors. And the commercial element of it has been completely removed. Why is this? Because people want to be of help to other people. They positively like giving blood. I don't do it as often as I might, but when I do, I enjoy doing it. There's something attractive about the idea. I don't lose a pint because it replenishes quite quickly, but someone else gets one for free, like that. I get a feeling of, well, not smugness, but a certain virtue out of this, and it hasn't cost me anything. I'm not an altruist or a masochist. I don't feel I have to lick someone's feet in order to do them a favor. And then I have a very rare blood group. And one day I'm going to need a pint or two myself, and I hope that other people will have been behaving in the same way. Now, what is wrong with that as an explanation for human solidarity, as I prefer to call it, human morality, and the self-interest, the evolutionary interest that's involved in it? Does that suffice? I know it's not a twanging hard on. I knew it wouldn't. Okay. So why do women, now Matthew touched on this today, why are women the mainstay of religion? That's a very interesting question, which you seem to be asking. I'm sure I know what the answer to that is.
Oh, do tell.
Okay. Well, one, I think for a lot of men, the non serviam that I mentioned earlier, the refusal to bow the knee to a paternal dictator. Someone, what is it? Is it God is dead or God is dad? I forget who said that, but anyway. Isn't as strongly felt among women. You tend to kind of quite like their fathers, if they're lucky. I mean, you generally do, right? Often a lot, a bit more than boys do. So there's that. And then I think there's the appalling risk that a woman has always had to take when she becomes gravid. I mean, she may die a death by torture to bring this about, and may lose the baby as well. And then, if that doesn't happen, but this is well within our race and folk memory, if that's avoided, there's no time of any day. I know this only slightly as a father, watching my daughter running. I think it makes me uneasy to see my heart running around in someone else's body. But it's much tougher for mothers, as I don't need to tell you. And there's so many things that can go wrong all the time. And of course, women go to the churches and they put little prayer flags out, or they because they can't. If there's a small chance that it might help their child, they're going to take it, and I don't blame them. But it is a terrible thing to see the mosques of Saudi Arabia filling with black draped babes at all hours of the day and night, and to see the terrible con trick that's being played on them. But if this wasn't true, and if this wasn't the danger, wasn't the situation, we wouldn't need to be having this conversation.
Hi, and in an observation, I kind of noticed that I seem to be the only Hispanic here. And I was going to recommend that.
No, I know that's not true, but where's Rodriguez? He's back in the bar again, I know.
I'll join him later. But I was going to recommend maybe Ms. Donnegan next year could flash a hologram of the Virgen de Guadalupe on the side of the building. I'm often asked why I believe as I believe or why I don't believe. And I think it comes down to an issue of personal responsibility, that I think that, you know, when good things happen, it's like, oh, God is good and he was the initiator of that. When bad things happen, it's like, oh, that person was evil. And people ask me, well, don't you believe in evil and Satan making people do things? And I tell people, why don't we just take responsibility for our own actions? If we do good, let's rejoice in that. And I probably committed a lot of the seven sins by not being humble, being proud of my volunteerism, and working with the Katrina victims and so forth, going down to Louisiana on Labor Day. And by the way, St. Bernard Parish firefighters, they still need help. And people ask me why I don't believe in that concept of evil, and it's only because there are mean-spirited people in the world, and they choose to do so, and it would behoove them to act in a noble, compassionate way, and they choose not to. The responsibility is on them.
Well, I do believe in the existence of radical evil. I couldn't tell you exactly why I do, but I could not say that I didn't. I actually think I've seen it in practice a few times, sometimes on the grand scale, like going through the bits of Iraq that Saddam Hussein's people had just combed through and seeing what they'd left behind. You can't, it's more than just violence and cruelty. It's what I call the surplus value of totalitarianism. It's the sadistic bit that you didn't really need to do, but somehow needed to. And the reason why I say that is because it's done in a way that's often self-destructive. The need to be that cruel and that ghastly must be very strong, because it's going to get you probably defeated and into trouble. It's a self-destructive element, and it's very, very frightening to see. And then a couple of times I've met people who I'm certain are motivated not just by self-interest and extreme selfishness, and because we say of the psychopath, of the sociopath, I think, we say they don't really care about or know about the existence of others, so only their own lives matter to them. But the psychopath a positive pleasure is derived from maltreatment of other people, even at the cost of their own death. They have to do it, need to do it. I have no problem calling that evil. We need a word for it. By the way, if you don't think we need a word for it, ask any Democrat at election time what they're about to do, and they'll say, lesser evil. They need a word for it, don't they? It needs to be in our lexicon, in my opinion.
But does that kind of circumvent the fact that we do have various people that do suffer from, say, like a mental illness, and we ascribe that to evil, rather than actually providing them with the help that they need.
Well, no, a lot of mental illnesses aren't evil. I mean, as great Colombian physician once said to me, if you hear a man praying to God, hear a man talking to God, that we call prayer. But if you hear of someone saying God talk to him, that's schizophrenia. All the evidence is that St. Paul, I'm not going to call it St. Paul, but Paul of Tarsus, no, my son, St. Paul, was an epileptic. If there's anything reliable about the story, however, the same is true of the man calling himself the Prophet Muhammad. I don't say that all religion is mentally disordered, but I say that it's inseparable from a form of delusion and hallucination.
About a year ago, I would consider myself a Jewish, not very religious, liberal. I went on a journey parts of...
Never heard of such a thing.
And after reading The Blind Watchmaker and The Self is Gene, yeah? Somehow I got moved towards reading books on religion. I'm not religious. And after reading your book, reading End of Faith, reading God Delusion, a number of other books, I would say I was an atheist for a week, and then one day I suddenly, when someone asked me, I realized that I was an anti-theist. And that's what I call myself. And I'm wondering, after listening to Sam Harris's talk last night, which I enjoyed, but made me think about that position, and living in a very politically correct world, especially in California, I find myself on a regular basis confronting and agitating my friends, my family, with this opinion, which I can't seem to let go of. And I was wondering if you could talk about being an atheist, you mentioned being an anti-theist a few moments ago, but what is your position on that, and sort of what are your words of wisdom?
Well, I've already expended them. In fairness, ladies and gentlemen, haven't I already answered that question?
Yes.
I think I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to say next question. Thanks. Only because we have so little time together.
After reading your wonderful book, Missionary Position, about Mother Teresa, I'm wondering if you're going to have a book about the Reverend Billy Graham, and if so, what would it be called?
I have to think, we are told that the Reverend's career is coming peacefully to a close. And I certainly hope that that's true. I regard him as I have to think of a title, and I will. I will by the time he croaks. an interesting book to read, by the way, on him is written by a man, oddly enough, called Templeton, Richard's favorite surname, who was the Billy Graham of Canada for a long, long time, was very close to Graham himself, and they would go on campus crusades for Christ together, and so until Templeton realized that there was nothing to it, and said to Billy Graham, you don't believe this either, do you really? I mean, come on, what are the chances? And he said, it's too late to change now. It's a living. He has a very devastating quote, his last chat with Billy Graham. Good book, it's called Farewell to God. Jim Templeton, I think, was his name.
Charles
Templeton. Excellent book. So there's that, which is, again, would make only the suggestion that Graham was another, or is just another figure from the Pardoner's tale, just another mendicant and fraud. But I think it's much worse than that. I think that the evidence is that Billy Graham suffers from a very horrible disease, a version of paranoia that's known colloquially as antisemitism. It's impossible to be mentally or morally healthy if you suffer from this disorder. All the evidence of the Nixon tapes that we have, and it's in very great detail now, and verbatim, is that he and Billy Graham, when they got together, liked most of all to talk about that, and to jeer and taunt. He was sick with this this conspiratorial, infantile nonsense, and that's not pardonable. So one will have to be, as well as quite satirical about him, I think very severe. And thus I don't feel any sense of embarrassment or apology in saying that his death would not in the least bit diminish our species. And that those who've fallen for him are very, very, very sadly misled.
Since the Iraqi war came up, I can't help asking you what your rationale is for the fact we all agree that Islam is a very dangerous religion, that it's going to take some time to make inroads on it. I can't understand why you would defend us going into Iraq rather than Iran, and why you would think that we have any hope in a confrontation in winning without some really horrendous results.
Let me see if I understand you, or rather let me be sure if I understand you correctly. Are you in favor of a confrontation with the Iranian theocracy?
No, I am not.
No, you're not. I thought not. You're just using it again as a means of ridiculing the confrontation with Iran. It's not, you're saying we went into the wrong country, so you should go neither. Well, I've met people like you before. It's easy to read.
That was not religious, controlled by a religious figure, and create chaos. Yeah. Rather than going into one that does have a religious figure, I mean, I'm not for either one, but...
No, okay. I know where you're coming from, as they say. an easy way to tell that someone doesn't know anything about Iraq at all is if they'll say one of two things about Saddam Hussein. One, well, okay, he was a bad guy. Then you know right away they don't know anything about him. No one who knew anything about the Saddam Hussein regime would content themselves with saying that. And second, to say he was a secularist. I can tell right away. People have no idea what they're talking about when they say that. Saddam Hussein's campaign of genocide in Kurdistan was called the Anfal campaign, after a surah of the Quran about the spoils that you may take from the victim, the devastation that you may inflict on them. It was Saddam Hussein who, sensitive to the charge from Iran that he was a heretic or an unbeliever, put Allahu Akbar on the Iraqi flag. That was 15 years ago. Who forced all members of the Ba'ath Party in the last 10 years to undergo compulsory religious education, who pumped out on radio and TV Baghdad and throughout his embassies around the world, and as you all saw it, a constant stream of jihadist propaganda, who undermined the secular PLO by paying for the suicide bombers of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and paying a bounty for every suicide bomber, which we found confirmed in the Iraqi bank records, was the patron of jihadism in the region. It was well beyond time that he was removed from office in Iraq, and I think the Senate did a good thing in 1998 and the House, on the initiative of President Clinton and Vice President Gore, to pass the Iraq Liberation Act, saying that year that it shall be... That I'm coming, I am answering your question, no, sir. Well, wait, I'm denying the assumption of your question that Saddam Hussein was secular, and I'm coming to Iran in a second.
We have to stop it right there. Unfortunately, there's still a little bit more that he goes into great detail about how he feels with regard to the war and his outlook on Middle East policy. If you'd like to know a little bit more about Hitchens or to see articles that have been written about him, go to www.dailyhitchens.com and check it out. Totally worth your time as far as I'm concerned. And this is about it for Savage Science Radio. I hope you have a wonderful week and happy trails to you.
Your children, they're too fat to feed. You're on medication, taking pills to sleep. I think I'm doing just fine compared to what you've been doing. I won't get vaccinated, insurance costs too much. I think you're so persuasive, but I'm not giving up. Saving my life, it's not what you're doing. I won't justify the way I live my life. I know we're living it, feeling it, tasting it, and you're just wasting your time, just trying to throw me a line.
make sure you join us tonight for the new...